somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Welcome to this bonus episode of Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech. Today's episode focuses on the here and now rather than the past. The coronavirus has disrupted life as we know it. Billions of people across the world are caught in varying degrees of lockdowns with severe restrictions on freedom of movement affecting both social, family, and professional activities. But while our physical world has shrunk, cyberspace has expanded, and many people spend even more time than normally online trying to understand the nature and consequences of COVID-19. And there's no shortage of information, as both traditional and social media overflow with torrents of data, news, and updates about the ongoing crisis. But in parallel with the corona pandemic, the World Health Organization has warned of an infodemic of mis- and disinformation infecting the internet and spreading through social media and messaging apps. This puts a huge responsibility on the shoulders of the gatekeepers of social media platforms who have to decide on what content is sufficiently healthy to consume for users around the world. These decisions have real consequences for the practical exercise of freedom of speech and access to information for billions of people. With me to discuss how Facebook is navigating this unprecedented situation is Monica Bickett, who is the head of global policy management at Facebook with responsibility for content moderation. Monica, thank you so much for talking to me today. I know you are super busy, so I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me. And we're in interesting times. It feels like just yesterday I was sitting with you in Copenhagen, and our biggest complaint was that the weather was a bit hot. And now we are living in really unprecedented times.
I remember that well. Yeah, those were happier days. So in February of 2020, you drafted a white paper on charting a way forward on online content regulation, which sets out two main principles guiding Facebook's content moderation policies. One is giving everyone a voice by preserving free expression, and the other is preventing harm. And those two principles are very much at stake as we speak. And you're the one with the Herculean, some would say, impossible responsibility for getting it right. So first off, could you tell us a bit about what specifically Facebook has done in terms of balancing these aims by ensuring the very real need to access, share, and discuss information, and on the other hand, to counter disinformation, and also perhaps whether there are differences in approach across Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp?
Yes, of course. And you're right. It's always a balance. We like to think that we're able to create a place where people can express themselves and also make sure we're keeping people safe at the same time. And we work with a lot of experts outside the company around the world to make sure that we are drawing lines in a way that will maximize both expression and safety. Specifically related to the new coronavirus, there are a few things. One is, again, maximizing expression is paramount. So we're looking for ways to help people be able to connect with their neighbors, their communities effectively, and also be able to access accurate information about the situation and about what they need to do to keep themselves and their loved ones safe and healthy. The second thing that we're doing is trying to make sure we're supporting health authorities like the World Health Organization and the health authorities in Denmark as well. And then finally, we are responding to misinformation about the coronavirus on our services. Sometimes that means working with fact-checking organizations. We have more than 60 organizations we work with around the world who identify when information is false, and we will label that and reduce its distribution and provide accurate information next to that information. And sometimes we are actually removing misinformation. And we do that specifically where there is a likelihood that that information could contribute to a risk of imminent physical harm. So an example of that, for instance, let's say there's a rumor going around telling people that if you drink bleach, that it will cure the coronavirus. Well, first, we know from the World Health Organization that's not right. In fact, there is no cure. And we also know that drinking bleach can be quite dangerous. And so in that case, we would actually remove that content from the site.
Depending on your definition of imminence, so it doesn't matter who, it doesn't matter whether it's a person with 10 followers or 20 followers. If you post something which you deem to have a risk of being dangerous to your health, you'll remove it. There might not be a great risk that a lot of people follow up on some person with 50 followers writing something. So do you make a specific context-dependent assessment, or is it merely the case that anyone who writes, drink bleach and you'll be cured, you'll remove that?
We don't look at the follower count, because even if there's, if this information led one person to take that action, it could be very dangerous. But maybe I can give you a little bit of context on how this policy developed. Originally, when we started getting questions about what we do with misinformation on the platform, we emphasized, look, it's not appropriate for us to be the arbiter of the truth. We don't think we can do it effectively, and we don't think it's the right role for a private company to tell the world what is true and false. And so we started working with fact-checking organizations to label when content has been ranked false by them and putting the accurate information from their sites next to whatever information has been labeled false. Now, beginning in early 2018, we saw some situations where there were safety risks on the ground in countries and where misinformation was contributing to those risks. And I'm thinking specifically about Myanmar, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. In those situations, we often did not have fact-checking partners who could assess this content. And so we turned to safety organizations there. And we learned that from these safety organizations that they were able to help us debunk rumors and tell us when something was likely to contribute to imminent physical harm on the ground. So we treated this as what I would call a break glass measure. This was, you've got a threat of communal violence, you've got a riot that has broken out, and there's rumors that could stoke that violence. And so we used this very sparingly. However, in the current situation, and also with the measles outbreak that we saw in Samoa back in the fall of 2019, we have talked to global health authorities and concluded, based on their expertise, that there is an ongoing risk of physical harm. So for instance, if somebody, another rumor that we would remove under this guidance is if somebody were to say, poor people are immune from the virus, or the working class is immune. And in fact, we've seen that content on the site. Well, that could lead people to think, oh, well, it's okay if I go outside, I don't need to take any precautions. And so talking to health authorities, we've thought that does present an imminent risk, because when somebody does that, the moment they do that, they could infect others.
Okay. I want to go back to some of the perhaps dilemmas involved in relying even on health authorities and governments. I'll try to show some examples that may show that there are dilemmas. But in terms of numbers, can you give us some numbers as to how much content you're taking action on right now, how much you're removing or downgrading, and how that compares with the period prior to the coronavirus outbreak?
Sure. I would say the numbers in terms of misinformation we're actually removing are at this point small compared to other types of content that we remove. For instance, every 6 months we put out a report on how much content we've removed. You can find that report if you Google Facebook Community Standards Enforcement Report. The last report we put out in November of 2019 showed that we removed, in the previous quarter, we removed about 25 million instances of violent graphic content. And we removed, in other categories like bullying and harassment, we removed about 3 million posts for that violation. Since January, with this virus, we've removed a couple hundred thousand posts for containing misinformation that could contribute to an imminent risk of physical harm.
Okay. And just to make that completely clear, how would that compare to the same category prior to that? Do you see a spike?
Yes. I mean, so for misinformation and harm, we haven't put out specific numbers, but that has historically been used in instances where there is a threat of some sort of communal violence on the ground. We have used it in health contexts before, including with this Samoan measles outbreak in the fall of 2019. But this is the first time that we have seen a prolonged imminent health risk where we've been removing misinformation. And so those numbers will be a little higher.
So this, as I understand it, means that your current enforcement or interpretation deviates from the normal approach to mis and disinformation in that you say currently there's a greater risk of fiscal harm and therefore you are more likely to remove. Is that right?
The approach hasn't changed. So the approach is if we have a safety partner or a health authority that is able to debunk rumors and show us that there is a threat of imminent physical harm from to people who believe those rumors, then we will remove that content. But what we're seeing here is that the threat is more persistent. You know, we just, with the measles outbreak in Samoa, it was a much shorter time period and it was much more geographically confined. And so this is just a bigger and longer threat.
So around a month ago, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights issued a joint statement by a number of independent monitors for freedom of expression and freedom of the media, including UN Special Rapporteur for Freedom of Expression and Opinion, David Kay, whom I know you know very well. And these independent monitors specifically warn that content takedowns and censorship may result in limiting access to important information for public health and should only be undertaken where they meet the standards of necessity and proportionality. So if you say that during this time, first of all, I should say, you're obviously not legally bound by international human rights law. You're a privately owned company. You can set your own standards. But do you take such standards into consideration as part of your policies? And would you say that this heightened sensitivity to and disinformation regarding coronavirus, how would you see that squaring with this warning by David Kay and these other independent experts on freedom of expression?
Well, first, I would say I very much agree with David Kay. As you know, we work with him closely, and I think he has it exactly right. And the principles of necessity and proportionality are fundamental to what we do every day, not just in the COVID context, but for years. When we craft our policies, we think about how we can make sure that any restriction we must place on speech is necessary and is a proportionate response. We have a human rights team that makes sure that we are talking to human rights experts and freedom of expression experts as well to make sure that we're getting that balance right. And, you know, I'll say, you know this very well, we get a lot of pressure to remove misinformation across the board. People want us to remove political speech that they see as an exaggeration or that somebody has, another candidate or another politician has said is false. These are the sorts of debates we see all the time, and we get a lot of pressure to remove that. And we've resisted that because we do think where there's not an imminent threat of physical harm, the preferred approach and the one that's more consistent with human rights norms is making sure we're giving people more information. And that's why we've built relationships with these fact-checking organizations who are independent. They are vetted by the Poynter Institute and certified by the International Fact-Checking Network for meeting certain standards for objectivity in their fact-checking. And this includes an organization we work with in Denmark as well. And basically, we rely on them to fact-check the material. And if they say something is false, we will say this has been rated false. We will give the information from the fact-checker, but we do not remove it from the site for exactly the reasons that David Kay mentions.
But so let me just push back a little bit, because you gave the example of someone saying, you know, the working class is immune from the coronavirus. You could say that, oh, that's dangerous, because then the working class is, members of the working class might believe it and might go outside. Whereas you might also say that this is just a statement which is so outlandish that it doesn't pose a real danger, and that most members of the working class are perfectly able to see through crackpot theories like that, and will get tons of information from their health authorities, which will tell them that is simply not true. So could you argue that maybe removing such content would not satisfy the requirements of necessity and proportionality?
Well, you know, we think that it's important for us to listen to health authorities when they think that something presents a risk of imminent danger. In that situation, they feel that it does. And it seems reasonable to us that it is necessary to remove that sort of information where it could lead to even only one person going out but contracting or sharing that virus. I do think that overall, we have a big role to play in connecting people to accurate information. So whereas we've removed a couple hundred thousand posts for misinformation that could contribute to a risk of physical harm, we have also launched ways for people to connect with health authorities. So we have now a coronavirus information center that you see at the top of newsfeed on Facebook. If you search for coronavirus on Facebook or Instagram, you are led to this center. If you are administering a group on Facebook, you're provided with this information. We're giving pop-ups to people in their newsfeed and in Instagram to get them to this center. And what we've seen is we've had more than 2 billion visits to the Coronavirus Information Center, which contains information from the World Health Organization and local government authorities, for instance, the health authorities in Denmark. And we've seen more than 350 million people click through that site to actually get to the health authority websites. So the numbers for the accurate information we're connecting people to are huge. But in those small instances where we think there is a real threat of physical harm to somebody, we do want to remove that content.
So the tests of necessity and proportionality might also be hampered by the use of automated content moderation. And unfortunately, human moderators are also at risk of coronavirus. And it seems, at least initially, there was this piece in Wired which said that a number of tech companies, including Facebook, relied on AI, algorithmic content moderation, which resulted in the removal of well-researched journalistic coronavirus stories from media outlets, including The Atlantic and The New York Times. But in November of 2019, you touted the increased sophistication of your AI systems. So how much of the corona crisis content moderation is automated, and how much of what is automatically removed or flagged would you say, what's the hit and miss rate? Are you able to do that evaluation on the fly?
We are using automation much more to review content, although I would note that the misinformation and harm that you and I have been talking about, that's done by people on my team who actually look at the content.
It might be flagged by algorithmic content moderation, and then it's a human moderator that has the final decision.
Yes, it's always reviewed by a person. But I will say the role of technology in all of this is so important for exactly the reasons you stated. We made the decision to send our content reviewers home for safety. And the reality is a lot of the content, and just to give you some numbers here, before this pandemic, we had about 20,000 people who were working on reviewing content so that we can respond to reports within a 24-hour period and let people know if it violates our standards. Well, after we sent people home, a lot of this content review, need for privacy reasons and for safety reasons, needs to be done in the offices. And so what that meant was we went from 20,000 people down to very small numbers of who could actually review this content. And so we did need to rely on technology. And yes, we've seen huge gains from what technology can do, but it's far from perfect. There are so many areas, for instance, with hate speech, with bullying and harassment, where the machine can tell you whether there's a strong likelihood that something violates, but ultimately you really need a person to look at it and make that final decision. And we've really been hampered in our ability to use technology just by itself, in the past, by the need for contextual analysis. So it was very difficult, especially at the beginning of this pandemic, when our numbers of reviewers went very low. We now have a couple thousand people who are able to review content, but it's still a challenge. And we've been very public about the fact that we do worry about using just technology to do this. Hopefully we will have more content reviewers back soon. But I do want to emphasize, with all the misinformation and harm reviews, that's done with people.
You've highlighted your use and reliance on independent fact checkers, and that, of course, sounds reassuring. But do you also provide transparency about the fact-checking process in terms of not only who the fact-checkers are, but what sources do they rely on, how many and which specific stories are being downgraded or removed, and so on? Because
right now, the science and our knowledge of COVID-19 is imperfect. So even professional fact checkers might struggle. And as I'll come back to maybe a little bit later, what seems to be good science 1 week ago might no longer be the case a week later as our understanding deepens about this challenge. So how about who's fact-checking the fact-checkers, if you like?
Yes, and that's a question we take very seriously, and it's why we work only with fact-checkers who are rated by the Poynter Institute and certified by the International Fact-Checking Network. What that means is that they have an obligation not only to maintain certain standards in their fact-checking, but to publish the sources that they use in their actual fact-checks. So the fact-check is basically an article where they say, this content that you've just read in this other article is false, here's why, and then they lay out their sources. Our approach is that we take that information and we put it on the article that they have rated false or the information they've rated false on Facebook. People still have the choice to believe the original post, but we are allowing them to see this information from the fact checker and the fact checker's sources. The fact checkers also on their websites list their fact check so that if you want to fact check a fact checking organization, you can go to that organization's website and judge their work for yourself. We are very public about the fact checkers that we work with. In Denmark, for instance, we work with Tjekdet, to help us assess content that is being posted in the Danish language and in Denmark.
But do you have like centralized statistics about this yourself where you can, for instance, relating to the corona crisis, where you say, well, fact checkers identified X amount of stories and we downgraded and removed X amount?
I have general numbers. Since January, the fact checking organizations collectively have rated content false that has led to us labeling about 40 million pieces of content on Facebook with a fact check label and providing the informative content next to them. But for the sort of individual breakdown on exactly what each fact checker has done, that would be something to go to their website to see.
All right. So you've already mentioned sort of the red lines, if you like, of where you draw the red line on mis- and disinformation. And I've seen you also remove a story about someone who claims that silver is a cure. But rather bizarrely, in the UK, there are these online conspiracy theories that link 5G to coronavirus, which has led to vandalism against 5G masts. But as per April, you had not closed down Facebook groups where these crackpot theories are being shared. So is that because you deem these do not lead to an imminent risk of physical harm against individuals, but only, so to say, physical property?
If you look in our policies, you'll see that we list the types of misinformation that we do remove for contributing to a risk of imminent physical harm. And that includes content that would encourage vandalism or other acts of violence like we've seen against 5G towers in the UK. And so, yes, we would remove those posts. Now, that doesn't mean that we would necessarily remove the group. Groups on Facebook can be administered by one or two or a couple of people, and there can be members that are posting this content in the groups. We'd remove the content. We would not necessarily remove the group itself.
Okay. Now, normally politicians go to great lengths to try and regulate content on your platforms, but lately you have actually turned the tables on politicians and removed, for instance, videos by Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who has said, among other things, what I have been hearing from people is that they want to work, where he sort of walks outside, and that Brazil cannot stop or will turn into Venezuela. So I think first Twitter removed it, and then you removed these videos as well. But here again, you know, certainly Bolsonaro is a controversial president and person, but they seem to be, you know, opinions rather than sort of factual claims. So again, talking to this issue of imminence, are those statements really bringing about an imminent harm, or is it because he is the president yet you say these are dangerous because being the president of the country, his statements are likely to falsely reassure Brazilians? And if he had not been the president, if this had been an ordinary Brazilian saying this on Facebook, we would not have removed it. Or can you talk more about those specific statements?
Yeah, so we removed one video of President Bolsonaro for the statement that said, hydroxychloroquine is working successfully everywhere. And that was in part informed by what we've seen is people trying to use this drug, even though it has not been declared a safe treatment, and even though there could be adverse health consequences for doing so. So we did remove that video. Now, President Bolsonaro and anybody else on Facebook, you know, if they share misinformation that's likely to contribute to the risk of harm, we will remove it. But they are free to share opinions. And particularly, you know, members of the government may have opinions about how long they think this is going to last or what they think, you know, effective strategies will be from a policy standpoint. That's all permitted. What we will remove from anybody is this misinformation, like stating that there is a cure or a successful treatment where it has not actually been vetted by the World Health Organization or other relevant health authority.
So what about President Trump? He's also been promoting hydroxychloroquine as something with beneficial effects. Have you taken actions against those statements? Has those statements been removed?
We haven't seen anything from President Trump that has actually crossed that line of what we saw with President Bolsonaro, where we saw that there was something that was actually contrary to what the World Health Organization has said factually. Now, it is okay for people to say things like, I think this drug is going to be a game changer, or I think this drug has great promise. It's also okay for people to share their opinions about, you know, how long they think this pandemic will last or what they how they think that we will end up dealing with this. All of that is okay. We are only removing factual statements that contradict what the World Health Organization or other global authority health authorities are saying are the right treatments for this virus.
Okay, so let's delve into health authorities. So we've seen health authorities like the CDC and the World Health Organization change their minds or even unwittingly spread misinformation. So for instance, on face masks, the CDC advised against the use of face masks. On February 27th, the US Surgeon General implored Americans to stop buying face masks as they were said not to protect the general public. Now, these recommendations were then heavily criticized by both ordinary people and scientists. And now the wearing of home masks is recommended by the CDC, and the Surgeon General has released a video on how to make one yourself. So my question would be, did you remove comments saying face masks work after the CDC said that these don't work?
No, we've removed only very narrow statements by people that are directly false according to what the World Health Organizations are saying at that time. Now, you're right, the guidance will continue to change, and we've seen that already, and I would expect that we'll continue to see that in the future. So it does mean that we will have to keep updating our guidelines in the way that we are implementing them, and that's why we'll continue to publish updates on our site about that. It's not perfect. You know, there's no perfect source of truth on the ultimate state of this virus. We know that their knowledge will continue to grow and their guidance will continue to evolve. We're going to do the best that we can to keep the information up to date according to what they are saying, because we do think they are the best. They may not be perfect, but they are the best sources for information on how people can stay safe.
Okay. In the same vein, so here in Denmark, our health authorities, who I'm sure have done a great job, but they maintained until April 9th that the risk of being infected by people who were asymptomatic was very little, even though several studies had already suggested that the opposite was the case. And until January, they described the risk of coronavirus spreading to Denmark as low and said that traveling to Italy was safe, which proved in hindsight not the best advice. But so obviously, we shouldn't expect health authorities working under great pressure with imperfect knowledge and lack of perfect data to get everything right. But don't they show the dangers of letting even expert bodies determine what is true and false in the midst of a crisis where everything, including facts, are in flux, and we all operate with imperfect knowledge and a lack of sufficient data?
It is imperfect. I would say the categories of information that we're removing right now, many of them are unlikely to change, frankly. These are, again, we're not removing unless there is an immediate risk of that it would contribute to imminent physical harm. So if somebody were saying, for instance, if they were criticizing the Danish government reopening schools, if they were saying health authorities are wrong, that the numbers have peaked in Denmark, you know, that's all allowed. In fact, we see that. There are Facebook groups in Denmark right now that are criticizing the government's approach, that's definitely fine. If people want to exercise more caution or say that health authorities should be taking a more aggressive stance to limit the spread of the virus, that's all fine. The only content that we are removing under this policy is something that is would lead people to believe it's okay to act in a way that's fundamentally unsafe. So suggesting that that certain groups are immune, and we have seen this, suggesting that there is a 100% cure. Don't worry about getting the virus. If you get it, you can eat garlic or you can drink bleach and you will be safe from it. That's very unlikely to change. And that is, if you look at our guidance around what we're removing, that is the majority of the content that we're removing, is those sorts of things that are unlikely to change.
Okay. So one of the things that has struck me is how fast governments around the world have used the corona crisis to adopt new laws and crack down on fake news and disinformation. So you could argue that China's censorship of doctors, warning about early signs of an epidemic, and also related chatter on social media even contributed to the spread of COVID-19. In fact, there's a story in the Associated Press today which suggests heavily that the Chinese government internally discussed that this new coronavirus, that was human-to-human transmission. They discussed that on January 14th, this very same day where the WHO said on social media that preliminary investigations conducted by the Chinese authorities have found no clear evidence of human-to-human transmission. Doesn't this show that your harm assessment may sometimes fail to take into account that the harms of content removals might drastically outweigh the potential effects of disinformation and conspiracy theories, which, when out in the open, can at the very least be countered?
That information, the content that you were just describing, would not violate our policies.
We also see crackdowns in Hungary, in Turkey, in Thailand, Cambodia, South Africa, India, Singapore, to name but a few examples. And in many of these countries, it seems that these laws are against disinformation are at least as concerned with protecting the government and authorities from criticism and scrutiny as with protecting the general public from disinformation. So is there a danger that Facebook becomes the helping hand of authoritarian governments in this crisis?
There is always the risk that governments will try to do that. And that's something that we've seen for many years. Although I would agree with you that there's a particular concern that governments could use this virus as an opportunity, while people are not as focused on freedom of expression, to try to get companies to remove more content. And that's something that we're very focused on. So to be clear, we do not remove content simply because the government asks us to. If they flag something for us and say, this is illegal or this is harmful or whatever, we first look to see, does it violate our standards? If it does, let's say it's a death threat to somebody, then of course we will remove it. If it does not violate our standards, but they nevertheless say, well, this is illegal. So you can picture, say, some speech that criticizes a government where that sort of thing is not allowed. What we do with that is it goes to our legal team and we assess whether or not this content is actually covered by their law, whether their law is consistent with international human rights standards, and whether it's consistent with our human rights obligations, and our legal obligations to block that content. With political content, we are going to push back on those governments. If there's something that a government asks us to block because it is illegal and we end up blocking it, then we do it only in that country. So people in other countries could still see it. And we publish that in a report that we put out every 6 months called our government request report, where you can actually click on each country and see how many censorship requests we are getting from that country and where we have actually blocked the content in that country.
We're getting towards the last couple of questions. You have for quite a while ago announced that you will be operating with a new oversight board, independent oversight board, sort of a Supreme Court of Facebook, which might have been nice to have up and running during this crisis. I mean, that would have been a baptism of fire for an oversight board. Can you tell us something about when that might be up and running?
Yes, we are working hard to finalize who will actually be on that board. So the chairs of the oversight board, and these are people who will sit outside of Facebook, they are paid by an independent trust. They are going through a process right now of vetting and finalizing the membership of that board. And then those members will be announced, and we hope that the board will, we should be announcing members soon. And we are hoping that later this summer, the board will be operational and hearing cases. And just to let people know what that means that if Facebook has made a decision about a piece of content and the person who posted it doesn't like that decision, let's say we remove your post and you don't like that, you can appeal to us. And if you don't like the decision you get from us on appeal, then you can appeal to this external oversight board. Whatever they say, we are bound by. If they decide to reinstate your content, then we must reinstate it.
So unfortunately, the oversight board is not up and running. Will you be evaluating your performance during this corona crisis to see whether you've erred on the side of voice or harm prevention, and perhaps providing the public a greater degree of transparency into the amounts of and nature of content that you have been removed in this very extraordinary crisis?
Definitely. This is being open about the work we're doing, I think, is the only way that we can actually know whether we're doing a good job, because we need the input of people like yourself and people from academic institutions and think tanks and subject matter experts around the world to look at what we're doing and basically grade our approach. We work with hundreds of organizations on a regular basis where we discuss. I mean, this is, I've got a team that every day is having conversations with external experts, talking to them about our approach and what's working and what's not working. We publish our numbers every 6 months, and we share details. Like, we'll actually sit and go over how we are responding to certain pieces of content with those external groups and people so that we can get their feedback. It's something I think is absolutely critical. We are not always going to be the best judge of the work we're doing. We need the input from other people.
Monica, thank you so much for talking to me. It's been very enlightening, and I look forward to following what's going on Facebook and Instagram throughout this crisis and beyond.
Thank you so much for the conversation.